Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman. Often on Sourcing Matters, we talk about proteins. And what we've been mostly talking about are animal proteins. Today, we're going to talk about a little something different. And I'm excited to welcome in a guest today that's going to share information about a plant-based diet and evolutions in that space. Now, I wonder, before we jump into this and talk to our guest today, I want to set a stage here and talk about what's going on with some of the interest in plant-based diet. My exposure to this was reading both of T. Colin Campbell's books. What they did an assessment called the China Study. It looked at 6,500 adults in 65 counties in rural China and started studying the effects of a plant-based diet, both empirical evidence and then specific statistical analysis on the overall health of individuals. And what you learn from reading his first book, The China Study, and then you read further down the path of Whole, which is his second follow-on book written about 8 years later, is cancer-causing effects come from animal proteins. And he, without a doubt, is pretty unequivocal in his assessment of what has to happen in moving people towards a healthier environment focused on a plant-based diet. On the other side of things, we also have Michael Pollan's books like Cooked and Omnivore's Dilemma, which look at an evolution of the Homo sapien, where we go 2 million years back and we do an assessment that we started using fire to cook meats. And that's really where the Homo sapien developed from their brain and their bodies by being able to unlock those nutrients and really taking those next steps forward. And then obviously that was expedited with Mesopotamia 10,000 years ago with the evolution of agriculture. So with that as a precursor and a setup here, I'm going to welcome our guest today, who is going to share with us some of the interest of a plant-based diet and look at where he's been successful in his restaurants of starting to move people past the perspective or maybe a misnomer that a plant-based diet lacks flavor or sustenance or satiation. And trying to get people past the idea that maybe the Tom Brady TB12 diet could be right for them. So today our guest is Air Muir, who's founder and CEO of Clover Food Labs. Hey, Air.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm well. Sorry for the long lead up, but I wanted to set the stage here. We got a lot of listeners that are into meat and into fisheries, so I thought it was good to at least talk about a few things and add some context of what we're trying to accomplish here. That it's what I get excited about, and we kind of joked in the fact that our sound check, Alex, who does sound checks with us, talks about what you have every morning for breakfast. And my common response is, I have the classic breakfast sandwich from Clover Food Labs, which is fantastic. It is one of the best, most, it's simple, but it's wonderful. And it's because you source such great food. So I want to jump in and start talking about the aspect of sourcing and kind of looking at how your focus on sourcing is really what it seems to me really been a differentiator in building your soon to be empire of restaurants and moving this in the right direction of a plant-based diet and looking at the future of foods. So there seems to be a trend here, Eric, where, you know, I'm a meat eater, right? But I try to eat less meat, but better of it. And what we've seen people is a more engaged consumer. And this could be a generational conversation. It could be more of where people are headed in the direction, whereas we become more concerned what goes into our body, how the food is sourced for the planet. And so we have more of externalities coming into where our sourcing practices are evolving. Regional instance or local instances becoming part of that discussion. So this became somewhat of an interesting initiative when Dan Barber's book came out with A Third Plate, which kind of materialized or solidified this idea that the protein, the center of the plate, doesn't necessarily have to be the center of the plate, that you can mix and match. And we've seen even more meat eaters starting to evolve to a balanced diet where you have whole grains, a lot of veg on the plate, and we complement things. So looking at that next step in sourcing integrity, can you share a bit about your commitment to good sourcing practices at Clover and what you've done to make sure that is a mainstay, a cornerstone of who you are?
Yeah. So when I started Clover, I wasn't sure it'd work at all. And I had read an article about food and the environment called Life Sucks Long Shadows. I'd always considered myself an environmentalist, but I'd never thought of food as being an environmental choice. So that was a totally new idea for me at that point in time. And I was a little skeptical and I did a bunch of research. And I came to this place where I was wondering, well, I thought I could have more impact on global environmental issues if I could change what people are eating than really anything else I could dedicate myself to. But I wasn't sure it'd work at all. And there weren't great examples out there to look at. There still aren't. But the idea for Clover was there's no meat on the menu, but our customers are meat eaters. So, you know, today, 9 out of 10 customers that eat at Clover are not vegetarian, even though there's no meat on the menu. And there's a lot we've done to achieve that. But I think that the flavor of the food we're serving is really probably the most important thing we have. And if I'm going to help someone fall in love with vegetables, they've got to taste really amazing. So that's where sourcing comes in for us, is really its connection to flavor and taste. If you're, you know, any chef, if you give them flavorless ingredients and they're skilled, they're going to turn to, you know, spices and fats and sugars and salts, maybe some fancy techniques to try to make do with what they get. If you give them really, really beautiful ingredients, the best thing they can do is sort of step out of the way, because, you know, Mother Nature can bring a lot more complexity and flavor to the food we eat than we can, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're starting with something great, then your potential is so much higher. Hmm.
Yeah, I think we find that in many of the best white tablecloth chefs, whether they're, you know, anywhere around the Mediterranean, right? They source just excellent food. And what they do is they complement it with technique or spices. But again, it all reverts back to being able to get good quality ingredients that are sourced properly without shortcuts often. And one of those areas that I wanted to actually, speaking of the Mediterranean or maybe Mesopotamia, wanted to bring up a specific item on your menu that I found interesting, again, being a longtime consumer of your product, was your pitas and some of the steps that you've taken to vertically integrate your program of bringing pitas, this 5,000-year-old bread, such an essential part for this, but you had to get it right, right? And this is a kind of a main part of your menu for where your sandwiches are sourced out of. How did you decide to, now, did you take ownership of the company or build your own to make sure that you're getting the pitas that you needed? Can you share with us and our audience a little bit about what you did around that?
Yeah, well, when we started out, I started with a food truck, as you know well, but maybe all listeners don't. The reason we started with a truck is because I wasn't sure this would work. So back to that lack of confidence in the start. But I shut it down for a few days. We went into New York. I found all of the best pita bakers in Brooklyn. We decided we wanted pita to be our primary bread we were using for everything. And I went around and collected pita samples from about 10 different bakers in Brooklyn. We brought them all back and then sold them to our customers and asked them which they liked best. So that was our early experimentation with pita. We found a baker in Brooklyn who was making really nice handmade pita. And this is like an Israeli-style pita. So for people who aren't familiar with Clover, it's a smaller pita. It's maybe like this, a little smaller than the size of your hand, and it's fluffy. So instead of, you know, it's not the, there's other styles of pita that are very, very thin and large. This is sort of a smaller, fluffy pita, and a little bit of a specific thing to find. There aren't as many bakers. We ended up paying some bakers in the Boston area to try to run pita for us. And we ended up spending $15,000 in pilot costs on that and never got anywhere. And over time, we just thought we could make better pita than we were buying. And so for us, it was really about taste. We ordered an oven from Lebanon. So there's only a couple places that make pita ovens the right way, and had it shipped over. So I think our pita oven's one of maybe half a dozen in the U.S. that are the style of oven. And maybe in part because of that, it took us another 18 months to get licensed our approval from Massachusetts to operate the oven. Ended up costing us more money to get Massachusetts to let us turn it on than to buy and ship it in the first place, which is sort of nuts and a statement about doing business in the state. But we got it fired up, and now we bake from that every day. And it's one of the things it's allowed us to do, and we get to control the whole process, but you develop a lot of flavor and fermentation, and we get better control of that. But one of the really special things is we're using local grain to make the pita. And so when you're thinking about eating vegetables, I don't think most people are thinking about flour and grain, but there are a growing number of farmers in the Northeast who are starting to grow grain again. If you went back 100 years, it was obviously very common. Most wheat and oats and other pulses suffer from or it can be threatened by mold and fungus. And the Northeast, with like our unpredictable weather, can be tough for them. So as people started moving out west, farming for those kind of things shifted. And what you do is basically you farm in a very dry environment where the only water is water you brought in. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's not very efficient from an environmental standpoint, but from a growing standpoint, you can control the humidity precisely because you're the only one adding water to the environment. And you eliminate all those problems. So all the large factory farming of grains really moved out west, and most farmers in the Northeast no longer had a competitive product, and so stopped growing it. But it's amazing if you eat. I got a grain grinder from my brother-in-law for a present maybe 4 years ago. And at this point, I think I would give up my toaster before I'd give up my grinder. Everything we cook at home is we grind the flour ourselves, and the difference in taste is just night and day. It's incredible. So it's a lot of fun. The pita we make right now, we get grain. We use Massachusetts grown wheat when we can, but we're using more than is produced right now. So we run out of that at some point during the year, and then we shift to Vermont and Maine supply. We're getting a lot from Maine right now. And about 30% of our the wheat we use in our bread is this fresh ground wheat. And another special thing happens, I can go on a tangent on wheat, but it's very interesting. I don't think most people know this. Whole wheat flour is not the whole wheat berry. It's like this big lie, there's many, many lies in our industry. I think we've got the most lying industry there is. But whole wheat, in most cases, is actually white flour with some things added back to it. And if you actually take a wheat berry and you grind it, you end up with a whole lot of pieces of that wheat berry that in that flour that are not available in commercial flour. And they have a lot of flavor. It also has a totally different nutrient profile. So one of the, you know, some of the things that are taken out in the processing are fat and protein, in part because, you know, in the case of the fat, it can go rancid. The protein can affect the shelf life. So the product you're getting in the store has had those things removed to help prolong its shelf life. But it affects the nutrient density, and it affects the digestibility a lot. Enzymes are gone. Fiber's gone. And then it affects the flavor, which is the thing we're really excited about. So this is a really special thing to be able to do. There are a few other really small bakeries in Massachusetts I know of that are using locally grown grains, especially back in Western Mass in the Berkshires and Northampton. There's one called Hungry Ghost that's really beautiful. But I don't know of anybody in the Boston area that's baking with local grains, except clover. But the flavor is just amazing. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it really, I mean, that's probably the next iteration, right? Because we've seen it even in some of our local breweries, we're committing to local grains. And what I find interesting, speaking of your idea and your perspective on, you know, this area once having so many stone mills around here along our rivers, and that nutrient density, that value you get, the flavors you get from keeping the endosperm, the bran, the wheat chaff together, basically, and grinding it all together, the enzymes that then unlock that you do lose shelf life, but you get just really what we're looking for in this food, which is provenance, flavor, incredible deliciousness, all these things that really hum, that make it. Yeah. And there you go. You gave us a great example of your commitment to looking at the sourcing, the transparency, the provenance of that food. And you're speaking, you know, I think maybe an analogy that our consumers may understand a bit about the grinding, for instance, or knowing where the food comes from, is coffee, which is another area that you commit to. You go and you do your due diligence. You find these places that are doing it a little differently, a little better. So you've worked with some of the experts in our space here in the Northeast. I know George Howell is one of the people you source with. And then we've also seen just smaller roasters and practitioners come in. But that might be an example for our consumers to get an idea, because that's become more mainstream, I think, you know, where we really do understand roasting practice and terroir. We understand fair trade. There's elements that are built into the structure of that food category that we just don't put into others. So what have you done within your sourcing practice? Because that's not a local crop. We're never going to grow coffee here, but there are a lot of the value adds that we can put into it here. And there's a lot of expertise that the Northeast can bring to market and source to our population densities.
Yeah, absolutely. I think coffee, as soon as we decided to play around with breakfast, which historically I was just running a truck, but I was there in the mornings prepping on the truck because I saved money. The commissary we were using charges by the hour. I had a whole kitchen in the truck, so I thought, why don't I just pull up early? I'll do prep in the truck. But then people started knocking on the window, so we thought we should have something for them. So the first offering we had is very simple. We had some muffins and oatmeal and coffee, just something we could give people quickly. But we make everything from scratch at Clover. We make our barbecue sauce from scratch daily. Anything you have, we've made. And so there are a few things that that we have a little less control of, that we have to trust suppliers a little bit more on. In most cases, we're judging the produce or something like at that basic level. But with beer, with coffee, there's a lot that our producers are doing before it gets to us. So we take extra effort to understand their business, who the owners are, how they work. For coffee, I used to carry around a list in my pocket before it got on my iPhone of like top 20 roasters in the country. And when I would travel, I would look people up and go visit. And so at this point, I think Clover's visited 26 roasters across the U.S. So, you know, San Diego, San Francisco, L.A., Seattle, Portland, Kansas City. We've gone to Milwaukee. We've gone to South Carolina, just all over Philadelphia, New York State. And the roasters that we really jived with, we liked the owner, we liked what they were doing, and we liked their coffee, we would bring into our program and rotate them through. So that's been what we've done historically, and we've been able to offer really beautiful coffees that are unusual. And I think in particular, it's been appealing to people who know a little bit about coffee and seek it out. More recently, and that's just in the past few months, we've been working on a program which would revamp our approach to coffee, and we're just rolling it out right now. Actually, this I just came from an event we were doing in Kendall Square, giving away coffee as helping people find our new program. And what we're doing right now is we're just focusing on four roasters now. So we had a lot of different roasters around the country that we had found and loved, but there are a lot of coffee companies coming into our backyard from other places right now. In the past 18 months, Blue Bottle has opened shop in Boston. Intelligentsia has opened shop in Boston. Counterculture, La Colombe. And three of these are owned by the same company. So I think that they're all great at what they do, but we have wonderful coffee happening here in New England. A lot of those things you talked about, understanding the terroir, getting differentiated price to great growers. Really, George Howell, who's in our backyard, is the innovator of all that stuff. I mean, he really set the path for the third wave of coffee, and so he has a really prominent role in our new coffee program. And then we're working with a couple other regional roasters that we love. There's one called Speedwell that's down in Plymouth. We've known Derek for a while. We met him at a farmer's market we had a truck at, and he's doing some really interesting things with coffee. And Tandem is up in Maine. We've been talking with them for a few years and admiring what they do, and we've brought them into the program. And then Little Wolf is the one we just brought in most recently. And it's an incredible lineup. I think they're all amazing roasters. They're all right here in our our backyard, and we'd love to shine a brighter light on that, because as you say, there's different ways to look at the the value chain. And even if the coffee beans aren't being grown here, which obviously they're not, helping somebody who's building a business around roasting the coffee and selecting the coffee, is something we're really happy to do.
Yeah, I got to say, you've got me hooked on good coffee. Going there for so long, I became a fan of Colectivo, obviously Intelligentsia, and I'm glad that we now have come common ground, commonplace on Little Wolf, because when I had it, I knew I had my skills have been up because of going to Clover so long that I feel comfortable. But I got to say, just like anything else, you invest in these things because it's an experience, and there is a certain, remember that what happens though is now I go to the other major brands, the big players, and Starbucks is, I can't even drink that stuff anymore. You get used to this high quality, great pour over, excellent, master crafted products. So you've kind of ruined it for me here. I got to tell you that.
Sorry.
So, I read a recent report saying that Boston is the most difficult place to operate a food truck. I'm sure you saw that. And I bring this up because you had mentioned you started in food trucks, and now you've gone completely into brick and mortar throughout the Northeast. So another part of that I want to bring up here is that, you go into a Clover and you have a very minimalist approach. Everything's out in front of you. I mean, you take open concept kitchens to a whole nother degree. Do you think your background in food trucks was that part of your influence for having the open concept kitchen? And also, it seems to jive with your transparency and traceability of your supply chain, where everything is out in front of you. You can see how your food's prepared. You got the best sourcing, and it's all right in front of you to be engaged as that consumer. So can you comment on that? Is that something that you focused on, or is it something that more of just an iterative process of it, that's how it came about?
Yeah, I think that most people don't know this, but if you walk into, a Chipotle or a Panera or even a Burger King or Wendy's, the whole restaurant that you see as a customer is usually about a third of the space. Two-thirds of the space is usually hidden from your sight. And this is even true in most more modern or contemporary concepts. So if you go into a Sweetgreen's, the chances are very high that there's an entire kitchen you can't see. So they're placing more in front of you because they think that there's a benefit to the theater of it, but there's still a kitchen you can't see. And even fine dining restaurants that have open kitchens, it's usually a part of it. There's usually another kitchen in the basement. And for us, I think from day one, I guess I had a sense our industry told a lot of lies. I think I underestimated how much it was. And by that, I really mean, if you just look at anything, and what's the difference between what an average person would think to be the truth and what's really the truth? In food, that gap is so big. But I feel like that's going to collapse around our industry over time. And maybe this doesn't happen for another 5 or 10 or 15 years, or maybe it happens slowly over that period. But I think that a combination of things, I think younger generations demand more transparency. I think we have things like cell phones that can capture videos and photos of embarrassing things. I just think this world where you can keep people in the dark is going to slowly disappear, and business models that are that rely on that are going to find themselves in trouble. So I think from the very early days, is almost a deep strategy to what we want to do and how we want to build a long-term company, we've been committed to really deep transparency. And so for us, that goes into a lot of different things. Our employee manuals, we published it online and asked people for feedback on it, and there were errors and stuff, and we got, customers were reading through it and telling me it should be like this, and we made changes where we have totally transparent pay practices. We don't have variability by role in pay, and that allows us to tell everybody what people are being paid and not have some embarrassment around that. But it obviously comes to food too. We're happy to tell anybody, what's in something, where it came from, how we made it. But probably what we do that's more meaningful than anything is just letting them watch us make the food. The restaurants, as you mentioned, are all open, and there is nothing behind a, there's no wall, there's no hidden kitchen at all. Everything you see is everything that there is in the kitchen, in each restaurant. And then we have a commissary over in East Cambridge, which I don't know, have you been by there?
I have not.
So when we built the commissary, most commissaries are built in more industrial areas, and we were looking at those kinds of things. It just didn't feel right to me to have a warehouse nobody saw. So we ended up getting sort of cheaper real estate in East Cambridge. It was more expensive than if we had gotten a warehouse, but the advantage is we could attach a restaurant to the commissary and make it 100% open. So you can go in, get a meal, sit down at the counter, and you're literally surrounded by, you know, 30 people preparing food. So the commissary is where we do heavier lifting, like making barbecue sauce or making hummus, things that require bigger equipment. And then a smaller prep is done in the restaurant on site. So, we've been committed to that sense of transparency through, I think it's benefits us a bit right now. I mean, I think it's part of what people associate with Clover. I think it's going to be a huge advantage in the future. So I think I'm happy it's the kind of company we are. I think that some people appreciate it. But if I were to judge it based on today, I'm not sure. There's a lot of work you do to be that transparent. And, you know, it maybe it pays off, maybe it doesn't. But I think over the long run, it definitely will.
Yeah, it's a progress, right? I mean, to your point, in the long horizon, I think this, you're setting a new bar. And we've been reliant on Bourdain's Kitchen Confidential, where people, I think, jaw-dropping information came out of that. And then shows like Gordon Ramsay going into people's back kitchens and people realizing their own backyard. I've been eating there for many years, and look at this terrible things happening in these kitchen. Or I thought that was fresh food, but it's been frozen for how long? You can't fake that stuff at Clover. You basically have it right there. And in fact, what I like too is I see your deliveries come in the front door.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I love it. Yeah. You know, it's so different than when the industry goes where no one goes to the front store. That's just for customers. No, you have these guys delivering, all wearing the Clover hats, all wearing the garb, pride, wearing with pride, and they're delivering this in the front door. So you see your food coming in and just sitting right there in your open kitchen.
Yeah.
So commended to be that. I do agree with you, and I think that is going to be you're breaking new ground. That's a wonderful evolution. You also mentioned, and I do want to bring this up because I think it's a key point. Your commitment to your employees to deliver a fair living wage. And about 18 months ago, maybe a couple of years ago, you came out saying you're gonna guarantee that all your employees that come in, no matter what they're at, are making at least $15 an hour. Now, that's for the type of employment in, I don't call it fast food, but you know, it's quick food, and it's not fast casual. You're delivering a higher quality product. But for $15 an hour, that's impressive. So how have you seen that? Has it been mutually beneficial that you've been able to retain employees because you're committing to high-skilled people that you're training? Are they staying and being involved at Clover? Are you seeing that they commit and will come to work when they need to, get retention, that they'll actually show up when they need to? How has the experience been, and where are you going to take this in the future?
So we've set on this path where, yeah, I'd like to get to an average wage rate where we get up to $20 an hour, and that's actually where I'd like to get it. I think that what I was thinking of at that time when we set those goals, and what still drives me to that is, I think that lower wages lead to a lot of instability in people's lives. So I'd love for our employees not to find that their day gets thrown out of whack because they don't have enough money to get on a bus, right? And I think when you're at the very low end of the earning spectrum, very small things can make your day or week chaotic. I think it'd be great to stabilize people's lives. And then I think it changes a lot of other things. So we've made big improvements. We're about $14 an hour right now. I think when we started this, we were at about $11.50 or $11.80, which at that time that was higher than Whole Foods' average wage rate. Mm. But it's come a long way. But
and what is minimum wage? What's the requirement for minimum wage? It's $7 or $8.
Oh no! In Massachusetts, I think we're at 11 now.
11, okay.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's state by state now. I know there was a year ago, it was a big commitment to that, but still,
yeah,
11.
Yeah, it's been going up. I think that it's interesting. We've made progress. We're a little bit stuck right now because you can't pay more without charging more. And we've made a bunch of increases in our prices. That's how we supported the increase in wages. But we've gotten to a point where our competitors are all stagnant on price. I think our industry in general, there's a lot of competition right now. And people are seeing declining customer counts. And in the face of that, everyone's scared to raise prices. So we're a little bit stuck. And I think we have to wait until we move past that before we get to make the next big gains. But I think that what needs to happen is we all need to spend a little bit more money on our food. And then if we do that, the people that are involved in making it can get paid more. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's that simple. But you can't do it overnight either. It's interesting. When we started this, we thought we would get all sorts of business benefits. I was actually, modeling and thinking, oh, well, maybe our retention is better, when we do this and we have less turnover. Maybe our training costs will go down as a result of that. None of that is proven. We actually have one restaurant that is an unusual one, and we operate it at a higher wage rate because of a union agreement with the landlord. It's a complicated situation. But suffice to say, at that restaurant, our average wage rate is like $24 an hour. And the difference between all the factors you'd like to look at between that restaurant and the others, we really don't get benefits. So I think that the higher wage rate benefits the employees, which in my mind makes it something we should fight for. But I really can't see any measurement at this point that to say that it's actually paying back to the business. I mean, if we're just making a business decision, we paid less.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, again, that's a commitment to the folks that, the face of really what you're delivering as well. And that's has to have some positive aspects and implementation for your brand too. So let's talk about, I opened the conversation talking about proteins. And one of the areas that I think you've committed to is staying innovative and keeping a new draw and interest of bringing people in. Yes, it's taste and it's flavor, and you don't promote them. 9 out of 10 people are not vegetarians, but they come in for something different. And one of the things that you've recently introduced are the plant-based protein alternatives. And so I want to talk to you a little bit about that and get your thought. I actually asked this question of Arian Tibermary, who is from Vermont Packing House. So his perspective, which actually is he was very excited by these. And believe it or not, people in meat do believe that we have engaged consumer. But, we process 9 billion animals a year. We got big problems in meat. We got to focus on how to get the consumer engaged more so in better values and products. So I want to ask you, because obviously you're sourcing these products now at your restaurant, and we've seen about $500 million investment into these plant-based proteins. And for some, it's the only way of the future. For vegetarians and vegans, it's a meat that is a protein that they can ethically eat often. For others, it's a fad. It's investors seeking quick hits to get investment on something new in food. And then for others, some people, the kind of the old school meat guys, Beyond Meat and Impossible Foods is Velveeta. It's Cheese Whiz. It's the same idea for them. So you've been selling Impossible Foods that we guys sell?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
And I've had it. It's quite good when you put it with the good sauces and cheeses. From your perspective, both as a business owner, but also you, Eric, individually, what's your take on these plant-based alternatives, and where do we take these in the future?
Well, I think we're all figuring that out together is the real answer. And I would say, Impossible is very interesting. We met them probably about 2 years ago, and then when they came and I visited them and seen their factory and everything, and when they decided to launch in the Northeast, they approached us about it, and I said, I don't think so, because we're not going to make a burger. And that's all they were doing at that point. They said, well, would you consider anything? And I said, we'd do meatballs, but I didn't think they'd go for it. And they came back and said, sure. So we were their launch partner for the Northeast, which means we just had their product first. And we did meatballs. And the meatballs we're serving, I think for many of our customers are the best meatball they've ever had, without any qualifications. And that's the kind of product we like serving. You know, we like to serve things that are really best in class or can be compared with other great versions of what they are. You know, coffee, as we were talking about. Mm-hmm. I'd like for you to be able to take Clover Coffee and take a coffee from, you know, from New York City or San Francisco and drink them side by side and like or prefer ours. The meatballs are, they're fantastic. The burger version of Impossible is also like really fascinating. I think it's altogether it's an interesting product, and we're trying to understand it along with our customers. It's been really popular at Clover, and I think, you know, one thing I'll say about this is the way our thinking about it has been evolving is I think a product like Impossible is not anything like the veggie burgers of, you know, that we've come to know. So I think as we've looked at this industry, and I think Beyond Meat even, you know, Beyond Meat in my mind is like the pinnacle of the veggie burger. It's a very, very good veggie burger. But I don't think anybody who likes eating beef and doesn't have a problem with it isn't going to prefer Beyond Meat's option. So it's a good option for somebody who wants that but doesn't eat it. Impossible is a different thing. I think that, you know, in the case of our meatballs, it's a better meatball than you can buy other places. So I think people that love meatballs come and buy our meatball. And not because it's not meat, but because it's a great meatball. Hmm. And so in that sense, I think Impossible's product they're developing is really more sort of beef that's not made from cows. Mm-hmm. And I actually, it's not a great product for vegetarians and vegans. And I don't really see that as being a sustainable market for them. It's very meaty. It smells like meat, looks like meat, tastes like meat. It's not a great option for someone who's looking to not eat meat, oddly enough. And I think in that same vein, Hampton Creek's Just Mayo is similar to that. It's not a good product for someone who's trying to move away from mayo because it tastes like mayo. But somebody who loves mayonnaise, it could be a great option for. So this is a really interesting moment. And I think that line, you know, we're going to get further to the space where you're going to have a distinction between where something came from and what it is, right? So I, like I said, Impossible is ground beef that's not made from cows. You know, up until Impossible, all ground beef was made from cows. And I think mayonnaise, Just Mayo is a mayonnaise that's not made with eggs. Up until that, all mayonnaise was made with eggs. So I think we're going to end up in this odd space where a bunch of the products that we used to have these assumptions about become something different. But I think it's going to take a while for people to catch up with that mentally. I mean, it's a strange idea. It's a different way to be thinking about things. In the meantime, I think people are going to shoehorn it into the conversations that feel more comfortable and those paths that are better trodden. But I see the potential for Impossible really not as an option for vegans, vegetarians. I don't think that will work at all. But I think it could be a very popular option for people that love meat.
Hmm.
And I think the big question for them right now is just the cost. Hmm. Right now, you know, commercial ground beef might be $2 a pound or something like that. Grass-fed ground beef might be $5.50. And Impossible is like $12 a pound. Mm-hmm. So that's limiting their market. But if they're able to bring that down, which they say they can, we'll have to see. I don't see why they wouldn't be able to replace a good portion of the ground beef in our country.
Fascinating. Eric, where can our listeners learn more about what you're up to at Clover via the web? And where can they come try some of these wonderful meatballs, coffee, and pitas that we spoke of?
Yeah, so we have a website, cloverfoodlab.com. You can just search for Clover and food and you'll find us. And we've got 12 restaurants sprinkled around the Boston area. So right now we're just Cambridge, Boston. We have one in Burlington, Mass. And then we have some kiosks in some Whole Foods, one in Sudbury and one in Westford, but primarily in Boston. And at this point, we're really focused on this region. Someday I will be really excited to expand to other regions, but we have a lot of additional stores we'd like to open here first.
And I think coming this spring or summer, you'll also be sourcing some local sea green salad coming. We've had a huge instance in the production side, obviously, where I focus a lot. We have 10,000 veg types in the sea that can be edible by man. We propagate and produce virtually none of them. You're bringing some of those products to market and now sourcing on the menu coming soon. Is that correct?
Yeah, we've been working with iron-bound seaweed for 3 years now. There's a tomato grow up in Maine that that grows tomatoes in a gigantic 55-acre greenhouse.
Yeah, backyard, huh?
Yeah, and we like their tomatoes a lot. They wait till they're ripe on the vine before picking them, and they actually smell and taste like tomatoes even in wintertime. And we played around, I think it was about 3 years ago, with a new idea for a sandwich where we would do, we have a really popular tomato sandwich in the summer that's a very straightforward sandwich with heirloom tomatoes. And we were trying to think of something to do in the winter. And so we made this Maine winter tomato sandwich, which comes on the menu in a couple of weeks, which is not going to be quite winter, but the season's a little bit later this year. But it's got a sriracha mayonnaise, and then it has a thick slice of these tomatoes, which are juicy and smell like tomatoes. And then in place of lettuce, we have some seaweed from Ironbound that we're flash frying. And it's a really cool thing. If you fry it very, very quickly, it turns like a bright green, and that's super crispy and crunchy. So it's sort of playing the role of lettuce, but but a little bit different and more smoky. And it's really delicious. So we use a ton of Ironbound. We have just like a whole, we have a room larger than the studio filled with seaweed, and it's all dry. We use it for soup stock as well. And then there's some salads, as you mentioned, that we use it for, but the sandwich is awesome. And that'll be on our menu. And I think it's coming out in a couple of weeks from now.
I will be there, and I will guess a lot of our listeners will be there too. So, Aramir, thank you so much for taking the time today on Sourcing Matters. I learned a great deal. I'm sure our listeners as well, and you'll have more customers coming, I'm sure.
Sounds great. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye.